Author and environmentalist Terry Tempest Williams will speak at Williams College tomorrow night at 7:30 in Griffin Hall. A naturalist and advocate for freedom of speech, Williams explores how environmental issues are social issues and ultimately matters of justice. Her next book, The Hour of Land, A Personal Topography of America's National Parks, will be published in late May to honor the centennial of the National Park Service. Terry Tempest Williams is the author of 15 other books, including Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place, An Unspoken Hunger, Stories from the Field, Finding Beauty in a Broken World, and When Women Were Birds. She is a columnist for The Progressive and has written for The New Yorker, The New York Times, and Orion Magazine, among others. We always love having her on the program, so it's a great honor to welcome back Terry Tempest Williams to our program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning, Joe. I love being on your program. And the size of your heart and the shape of your mind, so thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I always am fascinated when you take on a new subject, and the new book is about national parks. And what led you to that direction of to look at the park system, but also its ultimate importance and vitality?
You know, growing up in Utah, we viewed our national parks literally as our backyard, that it was our land, our inheritance, whether it was Zion National Park, Bryce, Capitol Reef, Arches, or the expanding horizon of Canyonlands. So it's really where my heart dwells. Every book I've ever written, every cause I've ever supported has its deepest roots in America's public lands. So it's really a celebration of our national parks, public lands, in general, and how it shapes us as Americans.
And during this Earth Week, does it give us an opportunity to think about all of that land that isn't protected and what we have done, and give us a chance to really have that juxtaposition between the two?
I think that's a great point, Joe. It certainly shows us what's at stake, that in, again, a state like Utah, where it's close to 70% all public lands, the majority of them are unprotected. And in the American West, whether it's the Bundy separatists that we witnessed taking over the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in January, or a governor like ours in the state of Utah who wants to sell off our public lands, our public commons, I think on Earth Day it does give us a chance to think about what our alternatives are. And we're hoping in Utah, for example, that President Obama will declare Bears Ears National Monument, which is being led by the tribes. Over 25 tribes in the Colorado Plateau are asking the president to protect over 2 million acres of lands adjacent to Canyonlands National Park. And these lands are extremely important to the spiritual and cultural well-being and health of Native people. And they're under threat and siege by the oil and gas industry as we speak.
How do you make the point, and how have these groups and organizations and activists like yourself been able to make the point of the spiritual importance and just the physical importance of having that land?
It's such a great question, and you know how to answer that. I think we stay engaged. I think we use our voices, whatever gifts are ours, in whatever capacity we choose to share. I think we talk about how much these lands mean to us and to the soul of the United States and actually the world. You know, most of our visitors in Utah come from Europe and Japan and Asia, and you know, I just think we take these lands for granted, and yet it really is the natural heritage, the natural landscape that sets America apart. And, you know, Wallace Stegner called our national parks our best idea. I would say it's an evolving idea. Because what's been so fascinating in writing about our national parks, and I've chosen 12 of them, is the shadowed history, that these lands did belong to Native people, that there is never one story of any one place, but a mosaic of stories. So this book brought me to my knees in so many ways. I realized how little I knew when I really started unpeeling the layers of what constitutes our national parks, from Gettysburg military battlefield and national park to, as I mentioned, Canyonlands, to Alcatraz, to Effigy Mounds in Iowa, to Acadia in Maine, to Big Bend in Texas, to Gates of the Arctic in Alaska. So it's a wide and varied physical landscape as well as cultural landscape.
When you talk about their deep history with Native peoples, is what we do in the protection of the land, and even in the case of the national parks and opening them up to visitors, are we being true to those Native people and to the land itself?
You know, the thing that has come to me is, you know, this is our history, and we know that we have a very dark history in this country. And how do we move forward? You know, I think about Orin Lyons, who, as you know, is a spiritual leader in the Seneca Nation. And he said, it can no longer be about the color of our skin. It has to be about the color of our blood. And I think the power of what we're witnessing in Utah and the Four Corners area of the American Southwest is the tribes are saying, this is an opportunity for us to create bridges, to heal our relationship with the United States government, even the Park Service. And what they're asking for is co-governance. And that's very, very powerful. And, you know, one of the federal officials said, but there is no precedence for this. And I loved how one of the Navajo leaders, Willie Gray Eyes, said, there was no precedence for democracy either. And these lands have a generational stance to our people, and can't we use our imaginations to see how we might go forward? That to me is exciting. You know, we're seeing this in Maine with the Northwoods National Park or Monument. We're seeing it in Alaska with the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge that could become a monument, as is being discussed among the Gwich'in people. So it's a very different conversation that we're having now than we've had in the past. And I think awareness is an enormous part of it. I think consciousness, and then the desire to create new models for how we reconfigure our national parks in the 21st century, especially on the centennial of the National Park Service.
We're talking to Terry Tempest Williams, author and environmentalist, who will be speaking at Williams College tomorrow night at 7:30 in Griffin Hall. You spoke a moment ago of our country's dark history, and you also spoke about the many plans to use this land for to transport and to extract gas and oil. That dark history can continue if we allow it to.
Absolutely. And regarding oil and gas, if we look at what's happening in our national parks now, 40 national parks are being threatened by oil and gas development. 12 of our national parks have oil and gas development on them, and 30 national parks are pending. So what does that say about us and our restraint? And, you know, from my perspective, our national parks are the closest thing we have to sacred lands. They're places of pilgrimage. You know, people in the audience, you know, I think if we ask ourselves, what comes to mind with Yosemite? What comes to mind with the Grand Canyon? What comes to mind with the Great Smokies, with Isle Royale, with Grand Teton National Park, and with Yellowstone? These our memory palaces. They're places where we go with our families repeatedly. And I personally cannot imagine not having our national parks and public lands to return to retreat to be reminded what it means to be human, and that we are not the only species on the planet that lives and dreams on this earth. They are places of deep resonance and humility, and I think it is in our best interest to protect and preserve them. As I don't even have the language. You know, I think of the bison. I think of the grizzlies. I think of all the other members of a larger community who inhabit these open spaces, these breathing spaces. And that's where I want to focus my attention. And I think there is such beauty in the world. And I'm mindful of E.O. Wilson when he says that if we are to survive and thrive as a species, it is going to require that half the planet be protected in wild spaces.
It strikes me, and I say this with great respect to those of our listeners who don't believe, who are atheist or agnostic, but for me, it is hard to go to a national park, especially the ones that you just mentioned, and not believe in something in the creation of how this beauty was created.
Isn't that, I mean, you know, you stand before one of the great sequoias, the great redwoods, and how can we not be humbled when there's 3,000 years of wisdom rooted in the earth? It just brings me to tears, Joe. What was the last national park you visited?
Glacier National Park.
I mean, and here's a national park who may lose the very thing it was named after.
Right.
Right? 15 glaciers remain. So it's a deeply humbling, poignant, urgent topic that I think we have before us. And where in Glacier did you go?
We went from top to bottom. We spent 2 weeks just traveling and seeing.
What a gift.
Yeah, seeing. And then eventually went up into the Canadian Rockies, into Banff, and which is also quite beautiful.
And it's such a beautiful example of an international peace park. And again, with the Blackfeet Nation asking for co-governance.
Right.
So it's a really interesting era, isn't it, in terms of how we're reimagining our institutions at this moment in time.
You're going to be speaking to the students of William College. Will this be the main focus, or will there be other messages that you want to get across?
You know, I'm so excited to go to Williams. I've never been. And as you know, it's the number one nationally ranked liberal arts college. So I'm so excited to listen to what the students have to say. They've given me a very challenging topic, which is at what cost? So national parks, public lands will be part of it, but they've really asked me to go to a deeper place. And I think I'll be talking about the costs of not being awake and alive and alert to a changing world, a changing planet, and what I believe is required of each of us now. It's unfolding. So I love that Williams has asked me to speak about something that's very close to me right now. My husband and I just purchased some BLM oil and gas leases in compliance with the law, even as we're challenging it. And we are just beginning to learn of the personal costs of this personal action. So they've cut right to the bone of where we're living right now.
That idea of cutting to the bone, I'm interested in. I love the words alive and awake. So if the information that we're receiving, if what we are seeing as a result of our changing climate, if that does not help us awake and become alive in our actions, then without trying to be, without being cynical, at least without trying not to be cynical, then what does? I guess I'm curious as to at what point do you have to get to where people then become alive and awake?
I think that's the essential question. I mean, if a tragedy like Newtown, Connecticut, does right. not awaken us to our problem with guns in this country, what will? And, you know, for me, I can only answer these questions through the actions of my own life. And I think for each of us to engage with where we are, who we are, and the gifts that are ours, to me, that's the hope. The greatest hope I see and the most powerful actions I'm aware of are those that are happening community by community by community with real people in real time, with leadership that impacts their lives. And I think that is what is being asked of each of us. I love how Bill McKibben, when someone asked him, what's the most important thing we can do to help the climate? And he said, stop thinking of ourselves as individuals. So there's a paradox there. Mm. In other words, we have to think of this broader community that includes all life forms, plants, animals, rocks, rivers, and human beings. But by the same token, we have to take responsibility for the complicity of our own lives. And it's difficult. It's really, really difficult. But I think it's all interrelated, interconnected. As you said, social issues, economic issues, environmental issues are ultimately issues of justice. And that's what I'm so interested in, is this interface between the personal, the collective, and the ecological.
Yeah.
To a sense of, ultimately, I would argue, the spiritual. We're not just in an environmental crisis, we're in a spiritual one.
And that seems to be a hard one for many people to grasp. I like what you said in quoting Bill, because it is that you have that personal responsibility, but you also can't be selfish. You have to understand that everyone else is what the responsibility is for all of us.
And, you know, I think maybe we begin with listening, really listening to one another, and to have our hearts changed, our minds opened. And, you know, for me, it begins always around our dinner table. We have many differing points of view around, you know, in our family. My family happens to be in the oil and gas business, so you can imagine the kinds of conversations we've had. And I don't even want to begin a conversation about what my father thought when Brooke and I came home having purchased two oil and gas leases. But we have started an LLC called Tempest Exploration. And what I can tell you after some painful, soul-searching, devastating, powerful, moving, transformative conversation, my father is now chairman of our board.
Hmm. And the idea is to ultimately protect that.
To protect what?
To protect the land. To protect the through those leases?
You know, I think we are in compliance of the law,
mm-hmm.
but we are also challenging it and saying, you know, how do we define energy? And we're choosing to keep it in the ground until science can show us that it is worth more above the ground, given the cost of climate. And that could land us in prison. And so, you know, I think we have to realize we're part of a larger movement, we're part of a larger community, and this is something Brooke and I have chosen to do, and we're interested in seeing how the law works, and it's really, really scary and exciting, and, you know, we'll see.
So through those conversations with your father, are you all on the same page now, or is it a team of rivals set up?
I think that it would be inaccurate to say we're all on the same page. I think my father's concerned, and my father knows the language of the oil and gas companies, And I think he also realizes, we went and visited the Bakken in North Dakota, adjacent to Theodore Roosevelt National Park, that the oil and gas industry that he was in, by laying pipe and digging the trenches for those pipes to enter where natural gas can enter into neighborhoods and service our homes, that the scale and aggression that the oil and gas companies are engaged in now is shattering people's lives. People go there with the dreams of becoming rich, and they leave shattered by the tragedy of their lives. Man camps, 12 men living in a storage unit with no windows, having never met their bosses. You know, my father tells a story of when they were in Evanston, Wyoming. He went to the Army-Navy surplus store and bought 12 cots and put them in a circle because they couldn't afford the hotel rooms and motel rooms. But in that night under stars, the men told stories. They cooked together. They slept together. And the next day they broke records as they laid that pipe under the river. That's a very different scale and point of view than what my father saw in the Bakken oil field. That was devastating. So, again, we're evolving. We've never been here before, and we have to reimagine everything, including our laws.
Without getting overly psychological as we wrap up, it does seem to me, though, that often in life we have those experiences as children as we're growing up, and we see something that is going on with our parents or in our families, and we can either duplicate it and we can keep living that legacy, or we can rebel against it. But either way, we come from it and we have those roots in a very deep place. So you questioning that after seeing it is very pure for you, because you have been a witness to it.
Well, it's certainly, again, we go back close to the bone. But I'm also aware that Brooke and I can do this because we're in a place of privilege in our lives where
Sure.
we can devote this time to this.
Yes.
And, you know, that goes back to the point that, you know, each of us does what we can do in this larger mosaic. And we do it together. And it's never one person or one action, but what we, as this larger community concerned about where we find ourselves, do. And I would ask, you know, the students at Williams tomorrow night, what is the cost if we don't do this? What is the amount of suffering if we fail to love ourselves and each other and this planet enough to change?
Author and environment.
And Joe,
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say thank you. Again, you just get right to the depth of, and heart of things, and what a privilege to have this conversation with you and your audience. I'm really grateful and humbled.
Well, I always love speaking to you, and I so appreciate the great work that you do and the beautiful writing that you provide us on these important topics. And hopefully you'll come back and we'll just talk about the book next when it comes out. Author and environmentalist Terry Tempest Williams will speak at Williams College this Wednesday. That's tomorrow night, 7:30 in Griffin Hall, williams.edu for more information. Terry Tempest Williams, thank you so much. Great pleasure.
Bless your heart. Have a great day.
And to you. Thank you.
Bye, Joe.
Again, you can find out more about Terry Tempest Williams at Williams College by going to williams.edu. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.